What's up, people? We are officially three episodes away from finishing up our fifth season run, our 2023 run. I'd argue to say it's probably our biggest and most successful, most consistent run that we've done yet. So naturally tonight, after a couple weeks of talking about, you know, a lot of different movies, a lot of different stuff coming out, we're just going to take it back. We're going to take it nice, you know, kind of quiet, kind of easy. A little bit of a stoner episode, if you will, even though, you know, we're not smoking weed, or are we? The audio listeners won't know. The video listeners will. Anyways, Dustin, this is a momentous podcast because we haven't done one of these in a while where you actually got a chance to come down and see me, spend a couple days with me this past weekend. Saw a couple movies together in the Big Apple itself, NYC, and we're here to talk about them. Sound good?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. We're not just going to talk about movies tonight. We're going to talk about the trip, all the fun times we had. We're going to do some reminiscing. It's going to be good. It's going to, like I said, it's going to be more of a chilled out chat tonight on the Talkin' TV podcast. Stay tuned. That was a pretty smooth transition there, wasn't it, Dustin?
Yes.
Almost like I've been doing podcasting for 5-6 years now. I don't know. It's weird whenever I talk about that. I'm trying to avoid going into podcast mode right now. Just like keeping it nice and relaxed, nice and chill. How you doing, man? You get home safe, okay?
Yes. I came home very safe. I wasn't accosted by anybody, and no one sat in my seat.
That's good. You had a little bit of an interesting ride down to New York City.
Yeah, this like former drug addict named Queen sat next to me.
Oh, she told your name.
Her name was Queen. Yeah, okay. I forgot that detail. Yeah, but yeah, that was also another funny part of it.
That is very funny.
But she was like hitting on me the whole time, and it was weird. And she's just weird. She was like mumbling to herself the entire train, and I like just had like a cackle laugh. Like people were like looking at her like, what the fuck is she on?
I don't think she's
on anything. She was just like,
according to her, she was just at a rehab. So
she's been at a rehab for like, you know, a good amount of time. And it's just, that's how fucked up she used to get, that it's like, it's done like irreparable damage to her.
Yes. You know what I mean? Yes, unfortunately, that is usually how drugs go when they affect the human system over time. But what is it she said when she saw like a group of just white guys come onto the train?
Oh, yeah, she just screamed Dawson's Creek. That was great.
That's funny. That's actually really funny. But yeah, so for those of you guys who missed the opening, and for anyone who is unaware, Dustin came down and stayed with me for the last couple of days. Came down on Thursday, just left today, Sunday. We hung out. We walked around, saw some movies, had some good times, went to some parties, we reminisced. So, Dustin, give us a recap. How'd you enjoy your trip down here to the Big Apple? And this is your first time coming back to New York since what? I mean, I know you had the thing that you came down with your aunt, but like as far as like actually like being in like the city and like being able to get around, what was this? First time since 2019, right?
Probably like last year when I saw American Buffalo. That was probably the last time I was in. Yeah, that was the last time. But movie wise, 2019, when we saw Uncut Gems at the New York Film Festival, and we sat in front of Silvio.
Yes, we did. And we saw the Safdies and Ronald Bronstein. One of the greatest nights of our life. But the Steven Van Zandt reveal is even cooler.
Yeah, and like I'll get to it later when we talk about the Sweet East, but that's another funny anecdote that I'll get to.
Yeah, there are a couple of funny anecdotes. So you came down, grabbed you from Grand Central on Thursday. We went back to my place. We chilled. We smoked. We drank. Times were merry. I woke up. I went to school the next day. You had a little bit of a interesting experience trying to find the IFC Center.
Well, yeah, I was trying to see the Sweet East by my lonesome, and Dominic was in class, and I was like, give me the directions to the theater, because like every time he was telling me directions like for the train, like it was like that scene in Good Burger where Kel Mitchell was like just taking Connie Muldoon's order, and he's just like, I just hear static. So I just like, just send me the fucking directions. And he did, and I followed them, and I still got on the wrong train. I went near Queens instead of the IFC Center.
Correct.
And but I got there, and then as soon as I got to IFC Center, I realized I was like an hour and a half late, so I just walked to your school.
Yeah. Saw some sights, saw some nice architecture. Yeah, that's a fun love thing.
Love the architecture.
Yeah, the architecture is worth noting. Yeah, fun fact, if you are not from New York, man, those subway systems can be very, very difficult to navigate, especially crossing across the I mean, you even said it, like I was explaining to you, like giving detailed instructions, and you were still like, yeah, it's basically like you're speaking another language. And yeah. In fairness, it took me quite a while to get it as well, get all the different trains down, figure out which trains run left to right versus up to down and which ones cross over. It's a lot. It can certainly be overwhelming, but we hung out. You got to meet some people from my school, some people who I will be introducing into the world of the Talkin' TV podcast in 2024, some new additions that I'm going to be making as well. Our friends, Jeremy and Mike, also got to meet. Finally, Dustin got to see a little bit of the inside of the other side of where I go to school at the Neighborhood Playhouse. So what'd you think of that in general, just the vibe there?
Everyone seemed nice. They were nice to me, man. If they were acting like they liked me, then fine. Then they succeeded.
Yeah, they succeeded. And hey, it shows that they're good actors. So
yeah, sure. If they can put up with my goofy ass.
Oh, please. I think you're a lot more tolerable than you let on. I'm just saying.
Sure.
But anyway,
I'm goofy.
You are, and it's why we love you. I know you're not used to hearing positivity often.
What are we going to talk about first?
What are we going to talk about first? Well, considering the fact that it was kind of
the whole... There's a lot of movies this week, just not even just the ones we saw together. Like
that's true. There are a lot of movies. There's one that I'm in the middle of watching. There's one that I'm in the middle of watching right now. I'm about 30 minutes in, and I'm very, very interested to see where it wraps up. It's definitely getting interesting. That Sam Esmail's Netflix movie, Leave the World Behind, starring Ethan Hawke, Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, and
I just
dropping the last name, just Mayala. I am about 30 minutes in. I am interested. I don't know where it's going, but I like that it's like doing the whole, it could be one thing or another. I feel like it's kind of some slight influences from 10 Cloverfield Lane and Bird Box, some other influences there where it's like kind of a closeted disaster piece kind of all kept inside, this one, this one massive house in the Hamptons where Julia Roberts and Ethan Hawke are a married couple. They're taking their kids out there for a vacation when a blackout happens. And then all of a sudden, Mahershala Ali and Mayala Harald show up on their doorstep and they claim to be the owners of the house and that they've come here because they just escaped the city from a blackout. And that's as far as I've gotten in. I haven't finished it yet. I'm planning on finishing it once we've wrapped up this podcast. Dustin, since you have finished it, what are your thoughts on it so far? Does it go anywhere interesting? Does it turn out to be rather predictable?
Starts off like interesting, and I think as a director, Sam Esmail like definitely gets a lot of attention. I just don't think it ends up in a satisfying place personally, and I think the ending was kind of obnoxious and inevitable. But the performances are solid. I think Roberts is pretty much the only one kind of miscast to me, but everyone else is like really good to solid in it. Especially like the kid actors weren't bad in it who play Julia Roberts and Ethan Hawke's kids. It's probably the best I've seen from Mayala.
Yeah.
Why she thinks she's Beyonce now?
I think so. She's going with the one name. Maybe Zendaya? She's trying to take that next slot. She's like, I'm next.
I'm Zendaya now. No, you're Malala.
She's a better actress than Zendaya. I'll give her that.
She's definitely a little more like electric than Zendaya.
Yes,
I would say
for sure. If you saw her on Industry, oh man.
I saw like the first couple episodes of that. She's very good on that. And if she were to play Rue, if she was like the original person that played Rue on Euphoria, she would have been way better than Zendaya. But yeah. I don't know. I just feel like the script kind of underserved the characters, and it definitely starts off with a lot of energy and like kind of like a a questionable but kind of like awkwardly cool opening cut to credits with a Joey Badass song and like that.
Yeah, really that was cool. That was cool. 70s
sharp zoom into Julia Roberts. Like, I fucking hate people. It's just like,
yeah.
I don't know. The
that's the thing I'm confused about. Is she supposed to be a Karen? Is that her character? I'm surprised they didn't make her character's actual name Karen.
Exactly. Right. That would have been way too on the nose. That's another thing. I don't know whether or not he's really going for satire or like a suspense thriller. That's the thing. Because it ends on a very like condescending, like
it seems to be like kind of stuck in the middle there and not really sure where it wants to go.
But the style is very good. It's very well shot, especially for a Netflix movie. Like it looks great and it's shot really well and it's inventive in that regard. But I don't think, I think it's way too long, and I think it's not that groundbreaking as it thinks it is. But
yeah, it's disappointing. I just feel like SML just hasn't been able to follow up with after the success of Mr. Robot. I mean, the first season of Homecoming is solid enough. I didn't finish the second season. He's produced a couple of other things, but I had a lot of hopes going into this one because, you know, I really, really, really loved the work that he did with Mr. Robot. Yeah. And I wanted to see more of that, where that came from. But
3 out of 5, 6.5 out of 10 for Leave the World Behind.
That's sad because I like the cast too. I haven't seen Mahershala Ali in anything in a while. Ethan Hawke, still great. I love Myala. I love everything she's in. She was great in Bodies, Bodies, Bodies last year. And Julia, I like that Sam likes her enough to keep wanting to work with her. That's cool. But yeah, I mean, I'll admit Julia Roberts has never been someone who's been one of my absolute favorites. So yeah, like her casting is weird. And in terms of the social satire mixed with the bottle horror and you know, the uncertainty, I need to see where it goes still. But the big thing that we finally saw, you know, it was, you know, it's in its limited release right now before it hits theaters, but it was Planet Lincoln Center. So we finally got to see the next possibly very big Oscar contender, Yorgos Lanthimos' Poor Things. This is his 7th or 8th feature film, I want to say, but only his 4th, I would say, that's gotten like a lot of mainstream attention. He's slowly picked up over the years, you know, his movie Dogtooth got a decent amount of attention, got an international feature film nomination back in 2010. And then I feel like he really broke out in 2016 with The Lobster. And then 1 year later with The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And then he started to get a lot of Oscar attention for his movie, The Favorite, that came out in 2018, starring Emma Stone, Rachel Weisz, and an Oscar winning Olivia Colman. Really, really announced her to the world. And now he's back after a 5-year waiting period with The Favorite, which is an adaptation of a novel by, Poor Things is the name of the movie.
Alistair Gray.
Yes, Alistair Gray is the name of the author who wrote this book. This movie stars Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, Willem Dafoe, Margaret Qualley, Rami Youssef, Christopher Abbott, Gerard Carmichael, and Catherine Hunter. The film stars Emma Stone as Bella, a young woman who was brought back to life by her guardian, the deformed and malformed scientist, Dr. Godwin Baxter. Yep. Initially naive, Bella is eager to learn about the world around her, albeit under Baxter's protection, and wanted to see more. She runs off with Duncan Wedderburn, a slick and debauched lawyer, and travels across continents. Free from the prejudices of her time, Bella demands equality and liberation. And what I can say about this movie starting off is that it's the closest that Yorgos has come to making a movie that really, really appeals to me. Like, his movies have all, like, come really close to being like, man, except with the exception of Killing of a Sacred Deer, I'm like, I'm almost there to loving it, but there's just something that's not quite there that's kind of holding it back. I've compared him a lot to Wes Anderson. A lot of people have already compared him to Stanley Kubrick. I think that it's just, like, if we're talking about his films as a whole, it's the lasting impact of it that I still like. He still feels like a very recent, a very modern director. His films, while they've certainly all gotten a decent amount of buzz, The Lobster even picked up a nomination for Best Original Screenplay back in 2016. I still feel like he has yet to make a movie that really I'm like, yes. And this is, I will say though, this is the closest that he's come for me personally. I really like the performances here. I really, really like the technicals, the production design, the cinematography, the score. That is all amazing. Like, the way that he crafts the worlds, and like, they're supposed to be set in the real world, but they're these, like, beautiful-looking, surrealist painting images that just, see, that just, like, I'm really fascinated how he pulled that off, like, how much of that was practical versus how much was CG. because I, you know, it's so much of the time now, it's so obvious that you can tell. And I really, really liked the performances. I liked how, like, you felt like these were, like, actually, like, characters that were inhabiting this, like, crazy, like, batshit nutso world. And, like, all the mannerisms and such, they were, like, all kooky and quirky. But at the same time, they also, like, he was still able to find the humanity in all of them. I thought that was really, really cool. Mark Ruffalo, this is probably the funniest that he's ever been in anything. Like, he was making me laugh hard. He had a couple.
He was fantastic.
Yeah, Rami Youssef had a couple really funny one-liners. Christopher Abbott comes in at the end to just steal the last 20 minutes. Downsides for me, it's a little long. Could have been cut a little short. I found the ending to be very predictable. Very, very predictable. And as well, the tone. I mean, he definitely is he definitely has, like, a very firm grasp on tone. But I guess my whole thing with it is the humor is interjections. They are funny, but it feels like it's like, oh, surrealist, weird, surrealist, weird, surrealist, weird. Oh, modern day joke, you know? And it's like, just like, it's almost like throwing it. I think I wrote in my review, it's like he just kind of threw in a ton just to break up the tension, seemingly.
I thought that was, like, the strongest aspect of the humor.
Oh, it was the strongest aspect for sure. Like the fact that it did come so out of nowhere.
Special to me. Like, what my problem with it was, like, you were saying, like, the climax is, like, it turns into kind of like a messaging, like, metaphorical, like, preachy kind of movie, where, like, becomes kind of like, you were saying, like, a girl boss movie when we left the theater, like,
right.
It's kind of like girl bosses. The only men that are unscathed in this are the cucks, and, like,
right.
It's just, yeah, it does read a little cynical, like all the rest of his films are, but this is definitely, like, arguably, like, his most beautiful looking one and his most different looking one. And the cast is definitely all consistently pretty great, except for, like, Gerard Carmichael, I find is kind of awkward in this, and it would have been better with
you
Chris
and I.
Rock.
You and I disagree on that.
It would have been better with Chris Rock is a better actor than Gerard Carmichael, and it would have made more sense as that character for me. But it's fine. I like Gerard. He's good. But Rami Youssef, it was interesting seeing him in this kind of a film. And I thought, despite, like, the first, like, couple scenes, I was like, oh, is he supposed to be, like, really awkward? And then by the end of the movie, it's like, yeah, he has some of the better line reads when those moments are called for, like when he's telling Mark Ruffalo or whoever, he's just like, he has cancer, you fucking idiot. Like that would be like there would be moments like with Mark Ruffalo, who is phenomenal in it. Like, Mark, this is arguably maybe his best performance, Mark Ruffalo, and he's so funny in this. Like, this, if he were to win, this would be like the equivalent to, like, Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda. It's a very reminiscent performance. Like, he's the same kind of character who sort of, like, doesn't win in the end, and he just gets shit on top of shit, and it's a very physical and blunt performance, and I think it's really awesome that he played it. And Oscar Isaac, like, they were teasing him, I guess, Mark Ruffalo, that Oscar Isaac was going to come in any second and replace him, but Mark Ruffalo is terrific, you know. Yeah, and Mark, he's Ruffalo been nominated more than Oscar Isaac,
right,
oddly enough.
Crazy. Yeah. Mark Ruffalo was really, really funny in this. There were a couple of times whenever he, like every time he reacted to, like, Emma Stone as she was, like, becoming more and more, like, aware of the world, and just the ridiculous shit that would come out of her mouth that, like, made
what
total
the fuck
sense
are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. That made, like, total sense to her and us, is, like, how naive she was to the world, but, like, not in, like, an annoying way, like, which it so easily could have. And just, oh my god, all the reactions that he had to fucking, like, at the end when they get thrown off the ship, and, like, my favorite part is when he's, like, doing the back and forth thing of, it's like, oh, he's driven mad by love and all that, and he wants to, like, marry her and such, and she's like, no, and then he's gonna throw the old woman over the board the shipboard. And then I was talking to him in the theater, and I'm like, how far would he have gotten her? She just if he had pushed her, she would have just fallen onto the lower deck. She wouldn't have even actually been thrown overboard.
I thought that was funny. That was hilarious. No, and yeah, just like Emma Stone too is just she carries the hell out of this movie, and it's one of her best performances. And it's one of the most difficult performances I've seen this year, and she pulled it off, obviously. And it's a good character.
It just proves how effortless she is and just how much she's grown as an actress. It's funny because, like, I guess that, like, I still have, like, the Emma Stone that, like, I love that we grew up with in my head. You know, the Superbad, House Bunny, Rocker, Easy A era Emma Stone. And then she's definitely kind of transitioned out of that and left that phase behind. But I guess that's why La La Land was still such a shock to the system, because it's like, oh, now she's, like, she's Oscar Emma Stone. She's only working with, like, certain directors. And it does make me sad. It makes me sad as well as happy when an actor gets to that level, because it means I don't get to see them in as many things. And, you know, obviously I'm still incredibly happy for her, but this movie kind of like brought it back for me, where I'm like, yes, I miss Emma Stone, you know? Cause like, as much as I loved her in The Favorite, it had been so long since that movie came out in 2018. It was 5 years ago. And I didn't watch Cruella when that came out, cause I'm sure that I know you and a couple of other people have said that that movie's good, but I still refuse to watch any of the Disney live action reboots as far as my boycott, continuing my boycott of it. And yeah, it was just so awesome to see her back in something again. She was so freaking good, so funny. It was just like, everyone talks about like how difficult a performance La La Land was. And I never really understood that, because I'm like, she's playing an actress. She is an actress. She should, in theory, be able to do this in her sleep. But this was like a really tricky performance, because she has to play someone that like is so naive and yet not a ditz. Because I feel like so much of the time, whenever they try to do that, whenever they try to portray naivete on screen, especially from the female perspective more so than the male perspective, it's just portrayed as ditziness, and that was not that at all. The fact that she had such a firm control and was so like solidified in her own identity just made her interactions with everyone around her even funnier.
Yep. And I loved Willem Dafoe's running gag too with Sammy Houston.
With the fucking, with the bubble machine?
No, not the bubble machine. No, that whole thing where like every time like he would tell Rami Youssef about like one of his like father's experiments on his face or whatever, right, like, or like all the experiments in general that he would be put through by his abusive father, who was also a scientist, Rami Youssef would just break the tension and just be like, what in the name of God? Like, Jesus fuck.
Rami Youssef was the definition of the, of what we call the audience avatar, where he's just kind of the insert and like the what's it called? The, oh my God, I can't fucking think of the word. He is the personification of the audience in there, where he's kind of just there to react to the ridiculousness that's going on and just like kind of just voicing like how like a normal person would react in those scenarios.
And I just thought that running gag was like the one of the funniest things about the movie, and I really appreciated that too. Like, it was just consistent, and it was,
and he's kind of just like,
it got funnier to me.
Yeah, and because he's kind of just like swept along and realizes that like he can't really get out, so he's like, okay, I may as well make the best of the situation. And so Willem Dafoe is like, oh yes, you will marry Emma Stone. He's like, okay, sure. And like, even the reveal around Emma Stone and like the whole like conception of that character and where that comes from is like really fascinating, and like how they capture that and like the movements of the character and everything. Like I said, this movie is so detail oriented. It really does bring back a lot of elements that I love about movies. This movie is so close to being in my top 10. Like, I was very strongly considering it throughout it. I'm tempted to go back and rewatch it again when I get a chance, because like I said, this movie does come very, very close.
And then Christopher Abbott too, I want to talk about. Like, he's one of my favorite actors too.
Oh my God.
Like, when he comes in, like, he really does steal the movie almost, because he has the, like, first of all, he has like one of the best accents in the movie. Like comparing it to everybody else, like, he actually sounds like he could be from like whatever country or setting this is. Because this is like a Terry Gilliam, a David Lynch, fucking Luc Besson, Stanley Kubrick amalgam movie.
Yes.
Where it's like, it's just pure fantasy. And a little bit of Guillermo del Toro as well, if you want to say. But just Christopher Abbott comes in, and every time he would just like pull out a gun, like, I would just die laughing. And like, he had that one line in the movie where he's like, well, there is no other option but to just pull out a gun right now. it was hysterical.
He just comes in the third act with Mark Ruffalo when as far as like the twist around Emma Stone's character. And you want to talk about Dion Waiters just coming in, stealing the scene, fucking completely understood the assignment, understands exactly what kind of tone he is. Christopher Abbott, he's a guy who's been popping up in a couple things over the last couple of years. I really, you know, I didn't realize that as I was going through his filmography, I didn't realize he had cameos in Vox Lux and It Comes at Night and First Man, which are three movies that I was, I was kind of lukewarm on the latter two. I really liked Vox Lux, but I didn't remember seeing him. But I probably first noticed him in 2020 when he was
interviewing.
Oh, that's who he was. I probably first noticed him in 2020 when I saw him back-to-back in Possessor and Black Bear, and then he gave one of the best performances in one of my absolute favorite movies of last year, ironically also directed by Gerard Carmichael, On the Count of Three, so it was cool seeing them reunited for this.
Written
one of the more
by the guys who write on Rami.
There you go, even better. So it's kind of a collaboration, another cross collaboration there. You've got, just one of the most underrated TV duos, one of the most underrated movie duos, buddy movies of the last couple of years, and you know, very reminiscent of movies like Running Scared. Again, more people should watch On the Count of Three. That's one of the best movies that I saw last year. And so you have then you have that, and then I saw him earlier this year as well in Sanctuary with another one of my absolute favorite up and coming talents, Marco Quali. That movie was more of just an actor showcase. It was another bottle setting, but the two of them are so good in that movie, and that movie is like so twisty and turny and comes at it from so many different directions that it's just, you can't take your eyes off of it. But he's really good here. You know, like I said, he comes in the last third and is just, they literally is obsessed with guns until they kind of just kill him and then replace his brain with that of a goat. And it's fucking hilarious. There was a bit there where you thought that, like, because it revealed that Willem Dafoe's dying of cancer, so you thought that they were going to put Dafoe's brain in Christopher Abbott's body, but they don't do that. And
which
I was a little
bit cooler.
It would have been way cooler, you know?
You know, instead of just, oh, fuck the men. There are pets now. And it's
It annoys me so much because this movie could have been so not that. Like, how much more interesting would it have been if she, like, you know, she had, like, you know, the saying goodbye to her dad, and then she became, like, the new, like, experimenter, you know, like the mantle passed. And then she, like, got back at Christopher Abbott for, like, you know, putting her through, like, years of abuse and whatnot by, like, making him her like assistant or like her new thing that experimented on. There were so many different directions you could have gone in with this, you know? And also I feel like there was no resolution with Mark Ruffalo's character either. He kind of just leaves the movie after he brings
I was going to bring that up. Like, Mark Ruffalo, as great as he is in the movie and as much as he kind of steals the entire thing from everybody, his character doesn't really have like a satisfying payoff. They kind of just have him do one thing at the, in like near the climax of the movie, and then he just disappears, and it's just kind of deflating.
Yeah, it is, and it's kind of sad because like he really was one of the best parts about the movie. Like the whole back, because the whole middle of the movie is basically just Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo on the ship going from place to place. And it's one of the funniest back and forths I've ever seen. Like when there's a scene where Mark Ruffalo, they're sitting down at dinner on the ship, and Mark Ruffalo is trying to tell Emma Stone exactly what to say. But of course she says the wrong thing to the wrong moment. And it was hilarious. And then there's this scene where it's like, that baby is crying. It is irritating me. I'm going to go up and punch it. Just like random shit that would just get thrown in there that I thought was so funny. Then they do this stupid dance number that is one of the most bizarre and funny things that I've ever seen. And then it would occasionally cut back to Rami. Also, this movie's use of color is really cool too, because it starts off as being black and white, and then it transitions into like this gorgeous color palette. And then it's, you know, kind of like settled in near the end, you know, once things have become more settled. Also, a gross misuse of Margot Qualley, who is, like I said, is probably my favorite, almost 30 now, actually, because she's turning 30 this year, actress. I saw her, I've been seeing, you know, I've been really, really impressed with what she's been doing the last couple of years since Leftovers. And there's
you don't get Margot Qualley for a role like that. You get Joey King or somebody.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yo, watch it. Not going to lie, it would have been really satisfying if I had seen Joey King get smacked in the face multiple times with what was that? A basketball. That would have just been so much better.
Exactly. No, yeah. But as I just want to say, as beautiful looking and as funny and as memorable and as quotable as Yorgos Lanthimos movies are, at least three out of the four of them, in my opinion. I'm not a Lobster fan, sorry, but they just are a little too cynical for me. Just a little bit.
I don't know if it...
It just, they prevent that, prevent them from being great for me. But right. They are very well made and good.
And my whole thing with it is, I don't know if it's the cynicism that is it for me. I think it's just like, I have just a hard time connecting with them. Is it? And I don't know if that's directly because of the cynicism, because I feel like there have been other cynical movies that I've been able to connect with before, you know, I don't know. This one came so close. It came so, so, so close. Maybe if it had had more of like a sweet ending and less of like a, such an abject messaging ending, I think I would have like enjoyed it more, because I was really, really digging it. That first hour, and even like the first, the whole section with Mark Ruffalo, and even the section where they led to her working in the brothel, which was just insane, you know?
Yeah,
and
people are making it getting repetitive for me, honestly. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because that was
That was a criticism that people brought up in terms of people having a problem with the repetitiveness of the sex scenes.
I was just like, but I get it. She's fucking a million times. Like, how many times do we need to see this? Like,
right. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, for me, I still gave it a pretty high rating. I gave it 4.5 out of 5. It's very, very close. It's in my honorable mentions. I'm probably going to move it up a lot higher. We'll see.
I'm giving it a solid 4, 8 out of 10.
Yeah, well, we'll see where it makes it if I get time to rewatch it. Like I said, we're in December, which means it's crunch time. A lot more movies to watch. We were so close to getting a screening of American Fiction. We were unable to, but I will be seeing that and Iron Claw probably sometime next week, along with Boy and the Heron and Godzilla Minus One, which I was supposed to watch earlier this week. I was trying to get a chance to watch Boy and the Heron. I just could not, because I want to watch it with the English language dub for the voice cast, and they are just making it impossible for me to find a screening of that to watch. And I was just way too shot today, because we went to a party last night and we both got very, very drunk. We had much revelry. And I passed out at it and have been hungover all day. So another fun hangover podcast. Woohoo! But yeah, but before we went to the party last night, we saw another movie, Dustin. And this one's a little bit more of a funny one, because again, we tried twice to see this movie, got fucked over twice by trains. Yeah. We saw Sean Price Williams' directorial debut, The Sweet East, starring Talia Ryder, Simon Rex, Jacob Elordi, Ayo Edebiri, Jeremy O. Harris. Couple other people that I don't recognize off the top of my head. What's it called? And Dustin, after two failed attempts, we finally were able to see it. We saw it at 4:50 yesterday at the IFC Center. What did you think of The Sweet East?
Well, it's definitely kind of a disorienting experience, that movie. Not gonna lie. It's definitely a trippy, like Harmony Korine inspired lunatic fringe fucking Alice in Wonderland craziness sort of movie. And it's a difficult movie to describe, to be honest with you. It's very difficult, because it's about this high school senior who's going on like this class trip.
That's the thing that's weird. Is she high school or is she college? The time frame in this movie is very strange, to say the least.
I think it is high school. I think it is high school, because it was a bus. And that's another thing. In the beginning of this movie, like, Jonathan Daniel Brown just shows up from Project X.
Randomly. He's not the kid with that pulls out the gun in the arcade, is he?
No, that's Andy Milonakis.
Okay. I don't know who that is.
You don't remember Andy Milonakis?
No, what was he in?
The Andy Milonakis Show on MTV.
Yeah, I didn't watch MTV growing up.
Well, all right, what about Waiting? You like Waiting?
I do like Waiting. Who was he in Waiting?
He was one of the bus boys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have to watch Waiting. I haven't watched Waiting in years. God.
You said, oh, yeah, and you're like, wait.
Ing. Sorry.
All right, anyway. Anyways. Fucking Simon Rex is in this movie, too. So two people from Project X are in them, because Simon Rex is in the extended version of Project X.
Wait, really?
Yeah, he was in the deleted scene.
I did not know that.
Yeah,
I'll have to watch the extended version of Project X.
Yeah, so that's kind of funny to me. But like, yeah, this is a fucking weird movie, because she gets lost on a trip during a school trip, and they're at like some bar or whatever, and then Andy Milonakis starts going in there, and it's like a Pizzagate inspired like. You know, rant that he's going on. So he's the whole time he's like, show me where the basement is. Show me where you raped the kids. And it's like, what is this fucking movie? And then like Talia Ryder just starts like, you know, she meets up with this in the midst of all this, this punk kid played by Earl Cave, who's actually pretty entertaining. And I've never seen him before. And he has like one of the, he was one of the more memorable things about the movie. And he has like a gag where he's like shows his pierced dick. And
that was no. Pierce inquires just one. He had that was a
no. It was the whole thing.
That was a pincushion dick, is what that was.
It was on his balls and his everywhere. It was everywhere.
Like, how's he have any feeling down there? Was my question.
Well, he doesn't. That's exactly. But yeah. So I guess I'm just summarizing this.
The movie is kind of like
this is how you describe the movie, because like I didn't even get to the next part. So like the punk kid is part of this like militia group that's after like these Nazis. They want to protest Nazis, and then in the middle of Talia Ryder like going to the bathroom in the middle of the woods, she stumbles upon the Nazis, and she befriends like one of the head ones, who played by a very nonchalant Simon Rex in a very atypical kind of role where he's very low key and very much it's very like subtle humor, but that he does pull off, and it does prove that he is a very good character actor. And he is funny in the movie, and he also is a Nazi in it. He's a Nazi professor. And then after that, he's also like a drug runner in the movie. So like she just stumbles upon like a bag of money and then meets up with the filmmakers, becomes an actress. And then her parents are looking for her, even though they could find her in the tabloids, because she's taking photos and hanging out with Jacob Elordi, who's playing a movie star in this, who's well known. It's just like, this movie is just an acid trip fever dream that I somehow did really enjoy. And it reminded me of like Richard Kelly and Harmony Korine movies at its best. But sometimes it just gets random and absurd just for the sake of it. I feel like, especially during that sequence when like they're just partying, right? And then a monster shows up out of nowhere.
That was funny. Seeing your reaction to that was actually really funny.
Like, but this was I was like,
you were like, it was hilarious. It was so funny.
That was
so clearly just like a guy dressed in a costume that was doing that for a bit. That was so clearly what that was.
But like in the movie though, like, or like, was that supposed to just be like a monster?
No, that was a party that they went to where that was just a DJ that was dressed in that costume.
But was he in a costume, or was that just a shitty makeup job that like, it was just fucking with my brain?
I thought it was a costume.
I just think it's bad makeup, and it was supposed to be a monster. that's how I want it. I sound like Billy Magnuson in Game Night. He still sounds like a scary monster.
wanted it to be a monster.
No, that shit was fucking bizarre.
Yeah, and then of course, you know, you have the Nazis show up to the film shoot and just start killing a bunch of people, including Jacob Elordi, who just gets shot in the head out of nowhere.
That was a thankless role for him, I think.
Yeah, and then she just gets like kidnapped effectively by one of the PAs who brings her to his what is it? His
brother.
That's
where it lost me.
Yeah.
That's where it lost me. That whole performance from that guy, and that's where it became repetitive, and like I started to feel bad for her character. But near the end, when everything starts to get concluded, and then it has that one last big reveal at the end, and then she just stares off into the camera and like, oh yeah, you just saw this crazy movie. It's like, oh yeah, it's a cool first feature for Sean Price Williams, who's a great, phenomenal cinematographer for the Safdie brothers and Alex Ross Perry. I love his work. But yeah, this is definitely a first feature in terms of like, not that the tone was all over the place, but I feel like the writing was all over the place, just in general.
Yeah, definitely. I'm with you there. Yeah, my take on this movie, beautiful cinematography. Love that, because I see like student films all the time trying to use the whole film print thing as like a gimmick and in order to try and like add texture to it. But this one, like, it actually felt like an acid trip thing. A lot of times, a lot of filmmaking techniques that usually kind of annoy me, I found that they were well utilized here. The whole, a couple of my nitpicks, I felt like the whole jumping around thing, there wasn't a lot of connective tissue there. There sort of was, but it kind of just felt like, okay, time to move on to the next location. Time to move on to the next location. Time to move on to the next location. It never felt like it was just like letting the scenes breathe. It was kind of more of a fly on the wall experience. And I feel like I would have been engaged more if the performance, but with the writing of the
character. She was great, by the way.
Talia Ryder is great. And
this
I definitely
the first movie where I was like, she's really, I get it now.
Yeah,
and she was hot in it all.
Exceptionally good in it. My problem was just that it's just the whole doe-eyed staring off into nothingness, just completely nihilistic, not really caring about anything, just flip-flopping. And I thought it was funny how, again, she kept going from side to side to side to side, you know, punk rock to Nazis to crazy filmmakers to like kind of off the beaten path terrorist groups. And another thing too, the time frame within which this movie took place was all over the place, just all over the place. Like 1 minute she's like on a high school trip, and then she's back with her family, but they don't tell you how much time has passed because it shows up like her close friend is now like pregnant and about to give birth.
Yeah, that shit felt very Harmony Korine to me. Very Harmony Korine. Like just little details like that where it's just like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if her friend is pregnant and like everyone's pregnant now? Like that's how long she's been gone.
Shit like that.
That's where you lost. You were kind of like confused by that moment when I was confused by the monster, which looked like a monster, Dominic.
I mean, the monster to me made perfect sense. The whole ambiguity around her getting trapped in the barn, fucking weird as that was, like I got where it was, although the final interaction with them where he gives her the CD and she looks outside and they're doing like these weird ritualistic cult things, and then they see a news report at the end about how a bomb went off in a stadium, and I'm like, okay, was that supposed to be the group whose barn she was imprisoned at? You know,
I guess it's asking
the audience to make a lot of assumptions without actually telling us a whole lot of things, and it's almost like you said, it's almost just kind of a we're just throwing shit at the wall and wouldn't it be cool if we did this, you know, and like a whole lot of experimenting without a whole lot, which is cool and fine. It needed more like connective tissue for me. I felt like it was lacking that. I think we could have had something really interesting because it felt like it actually did have something that it like wanted to say about all these different kind of targets and think groups that it was all hitting and stuff like that. It was ones that it was clearly satirizing, others that it was like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe we shouldn't just take all these people for granted. Maybe there is some nuance and some layering
here. Is she like a voyeur? Is that what it was where she was just like,
I mean, it's what it had to be. It's clearly what it was meant to be. I just found that there
were not specifically supposed to be that likable, I don't think, because she's not really as a character written, and no one in this movie is very likable, but the movie I feel wants you to be like, oh, look how toxic every guy is and how
I just thought she was a blank slate was my issue. I thought she was a blank slate that like they were trying to have the audience like map themselves onto, is be like, oh, this could literally be anyone, and it's like, yeah, but they're also trying to portray her as being like a shitty, like, you know, spoiled Gen Z, or where it's like kind of just like, you know, wandering around blank expression, just like, you know, just being taken in by various and assorted groups of people and just seeing how she reacts to it. And the minute she like decides to like get out or something, like the only one that she wanted to stay in was the movie star thing, obviously. And then, you know, the Nazis come in and kind of disrupt that. But
each vignette, so to speak, was like decreasing in quality for me.
Yeah.
I just felt like it started off, like the first 25, 30 minutes, I felt started off kind of strong. And then it kind of petered out a little bit, especially with like the little camp. But that performance really does carry the entire movie, the Ryder performance. And I give it a 3.5 out of 5, 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah, it was an impressive performance, to say the least. I believe I gave this a 4 out of 5. I did enjoy it. I enjoyed it for its originality. I enjoyed it for it being different than a majority of the movies I've seen so far this year. Like I said, it's just the off the beaten path movies, though, are the ones where I usually just, the ones that don't have a lot of hype around them are usually the ones that I'm more interested in and have more fun with. And I gotta say, from August until now, a couple of these off the beaten path movies have really been, they've really been pretty impressive. You know, I'm still sad that Challengers and Driveaway Dolls got pushed, because I think those two also would have been interesting to watch and see if it was part of the conversation as well. But as far as where things are right now, before we got out of here, I want to talk about Poor Things Oscars chances, because we both have seen a couple of movies in the last couple of months that we thought were going to be up for certain Oscars. Now, I do not know if that is necessarily the case. You know, I saw Saltburn a couple of weeks ago. I don't think that's going to get as many Oscar nominations as Promising a Woman. And with Poor Things, I think this will get a lot of nominations. Do I think it's going to win any outside of the technicals? I see this maybe splitting the difference with Oppenheimer when it comes to technicals. Because up until this point, I was convinced Oppenheimer was winning every technicals, and I still think it will. But I think that this is a strong contender for cinematography, for production design, for costumes, right? Hair and makeup, all that. I think this is a strong contender for that. But as far as the big ones, maybe Emma Stone for actress. That's the closest I can think. But I don't think she's winning over Lily Gladstone or Carey Mulligan. Because I think those two are like the top two contenders right now. I think Ruffalo will be nominated. I think Defoe could be nominated. I think that it will be nominated for screenplay. Yorgos, I think, will be nominated again for directing. But will it win anything? I don't know. I think at this point, Oppenheimer's the lock. I really do think.
Yeah. This is such a, that's too pervy and weird for them.
Yeah. Just the fact that it'll be nominated will be interesting enough. Because, like, what I've noticed is that, like, it's been, like, a common track record where, like, you can kind of figure out what's going to win, like, by the end of the year. Like, I feel like the winners have become even more predictable, like, ever since Nomadland, right? Like, I feel like 2019 was the last, like, kind of ambiguous surprise year where there were, like, four or five different movies that were, like, up for it. Like, it was circulating. It was like, oh, it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's 1917.
Parasite.
Well, but then Parasite comes out of nowhere and wins it. But, like, for the last couple of years, it's been pretty obvious that Nomadland, that Coda, that Everything Everywhere All at Once were going to win. And this year, I think it's a shoe-in. I think Oppenheimer is the shoe-in, the safe bet to win.
Yeah.
I think it's going to get Chris Nolan his best director win, finally.
Good.
After all these years, he well-deserved it by this point.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to say it right now. I think that everyone who thinks that Bradley Cooper is going to win for Maestro, I think that to still look out for Cillian Murphy. Cause I definitely think that, cause if they nominate Maestro for musical tomorrow with the Golden Globes and Cillian Murphy wins drama, then I think he's got a good shot, especially cause he's got the narrative around him versus Bradley Cooper, who has kind of the traditional tired out Oscar run.
If Cillian Murphy wins SAG,
that would be cool.
Then I can see where you're coming from.
I'm not saying he's gonna win. I'm just saying I think he has more of a chance than people maybe think.
He's definitely a contender. It's between him, Giamatti, and Cooper, but Cooper has the most overdue narrative.
Yes, he does at this point, especially after the whole Star Is Born.
And it's the most baity. As someone who saw Maestro already. It's the most Beatty Oscar friendly performance I've seen in a minute.
Yeah, we're going to talk
very good in it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a couple weeks when we talk about Maestro. Like I've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, we got a couple more. We got two episodes left for 2023 before we are officially finished, and then we'll hop into January. I've already got the slate lined up for that. We're going to have a couple of more mini episodes. I might add American Fiction and Ferrari to the slate of movies for the finale. If I don't cover American Fiction, actually, no, I'm wrong. I'm covering American Fiction next week with Gal Balaban, along with Wonka and along with Wonka and Anyone But You. And then I think I'm going to add Ferrari to the final lineup as well, along with Aquaman, Rebel Moon, Iron Claw, and Maestro. So we're going to cover all of those, and we'll be talking about all of those movies and all of their Oscar chances as we get progressively closer. The visual effects lineup just got really, really interesting. That is pretty much it for tonight. Like I said, people, two episodes left, so be sure to stay tuned. We've been having such a great year, such a great season. We've had a lot of fun with this. I hope to continue this into 2024 with all of the things that are already getting lined up for the spring as well. We have Dune in March. We got a full slate for January. We got some interesting February releases, some interesting Netflix stuff that will be coming out. So much more content as always. And Dustin, I will be having you on for plenty of episodes come the new year. Where can the good people follow you on the interwebs?
Letterboxd, Dustin Mason, YouTube.com, Mr. G Movie Reviews, and Twitter. Buster Rhymes. And I saw like Meg Bitchell, that fucking letterbox reviewer when you were in the bathroom when we were leaving Sweet East.
Yeah.
She was at that theater, and I was just like, this is the biggest celebrity I've seen in the city.
Yeah, surprisingly celebrity-less weekend. I was actually kind of a little bit distressed by that. I'm like, that usually doesn't happen. We're usually
Meg Bitchell is the fucking biggest celebrity I've seen. Then
yeah. Although in fairness, now that they're all back to work, yeah, that's probably what it is. They're probably all busy. But yeah, you can follow me, of course, with everything going on at Movie Nerd Reviews across all platforms. Be sure to follow the official Talking TV podcast across all platforms. Subscribe to us if you're watching us on YouTube. Follow us on Twitch. This episode will be available on Spotify and Apple Podcasts tomorrow. And as always, people, 12 seasons in a short film. And watch more fucking movies. We had a shorter episode tonight, but that's fine. We'll see you next week for Wonka, Anyone But You, and American Fiction. Take care. Have a good night.
Fuck Glenn Powell.
Fuck Glenn Powell.